Welcome to the Run Nerd Library Podcast, a podcast for those who eat, sleep, breathe, train, think, talk, and read about running, and those who are curious. I'm the host, Don Hahn, a self-proclaimed run nerd. I consider myself more of a running enthusiast than an expert, fueled by coffee and blind optimism. This podcast will feature running experts talking about their books and enthusiasts like me who are here to discuss their books with them. Whether you're listening on your commute or on your run, we are happy to have you here. Welcome back to the Run Nerd Library Podcast. I'm your host, Don Hahn, and with me today is Coach Scott Litzkin from Westfield High School right here in Westfield, Indiana. Scott is a four-time girls high school state champion coach here in Indiana. He's also a talented athlete in his own right, a sub-14 minute 5K runner, sub-30 minute 10K, 65 minutes for the half marathon. He's a Butler graduate from the state of Illinois, and when he graduated, he signed a professional contract with ASICS to be a professional runner before he started his career as a coach at the high school level. Scott, welcome to the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. I would love to hear from you. One of my favorite questions to ask my guests is, what got you started in running? How did you get, what was the initial push for you to get that love of the sport?
I didn't love it right away, I'll tell you that. So I was, believe it or not, a basketball player growing up in the Chicago area. I grew up right in the prime of Michael Jordan years. So I wanted to be a hoops player. And my freshman year in high school, I was ready to play basketball, and we did our basketball conditioning for the team. And I don't know why, but the first day of conditioning, our coach had us do a 30-minute run on the track, which is, looking back on it, a little crazy, but okay. So I guess I ran a lot of laps. I don't remember, but my basketball coach came up to me at the end of it, and he said, basically, you're going to run cross country, or I'm going to cut you from the basketball team.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Which would never happen today, right? Yeah. Like, it would never happen today. And so he was an intimidating, basketball coach, somebody I respect. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to run cross country. And I had no idea what cross country was. I didn't even know what it was.
Yeah.
So I went to the cross country practice the next day, and I realized I'm going to be running a lot. So that's kind of how I got introduced into the sports. I ran my freshman year in high school in cross country. But by that time, conditioning didn't start for basketball until, I don't know the date, maybe mid-September. So I only had maybe 3 weeks of a cross-country season. And I guess I liked it enough. I told my cross-country coach that I would try it the next year if I couldn't make the golf team. So I played golf all the next summer.
Yeah.
I didn't run track my freshman year. I played baseball.
Okay.
And so I played golf the whole summer. And I told him, if I break 100, I'm gonna join the golf team, and if I don't, I'll come back for cross country. So I played around at the end of the summer, and I shot like 103, and I was like, "Yeah, I guess I'm gonna run cross country." And I stuck with it.
So you owe your running career to maybe a few sliced golf balls or
a couple
of bunkers on the course somewhere.
And certainly that basketball coach, Rob Judson, was my coach. He really recognized that there was some talent, and I'm grateful for that.
For sure, for sure. And it sounds like you were into all sports in high school, trying different things to find where your talents and your passion really lie.
Huge sports family, huge Cubs fans, Bears, Bulls, now Butler.
Yeah.
Huge, huge sports fans. So I tried a little bit of everything and found my way to running.
That was a great time to definitely be a Bulls fan in the 90s.
Yes, it was.
A lot of great seasons there, a lot of celebrations. So talk to us about getting into coaching, and we'll talk about this in the second segment when we get into your book, Sisu, Lessons from the Cross Country Course. But I want to just kind of get a feel for, what was it that drove you into coaching? Why did you make that choice?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I in college, I ran at Butler, and I guess I knew I would coach one day.
Mm-hmm.
I was an education major, well, actually I was an English major getting my education, my teaching license. And I worked at All-Star Cross Country Camp, Coach Chuck Kepin's camp, kind of a legend in the high school coaching world here in Indiana. He coached at Carmel for decades. and unbelievably successful. And so he invited me to work his camp that he had every summer 1 year. And I had a blast. And I remember the coach, one of the counselors there was the head coach at Westfield. And I was just there to kind of pick the brains of all these coaches because I wanted to learn more about running in case I coached one day. Well, it was a great week. We had a blast. And like literally 5-6 days later, Coach Kepin called me and the coach at Westfield called me and said, hey, his name was Scott Meller, the coach at Westfield at the time. And he said, I think I'm going to take a job somewhere else. Are you interested in coaching at Westfield? And I literally had, I didn't even know what Westfield was. And I said, well, I'll hear you out. Let's go interview and let's talk about it. And so, so I sat down with the principal and the athletic director and and wound up taking the job at Westfield without, I mean, it was much earlier than I had expected to begin coaching, but my experience through working with Coach Kepin and working at the camp, I kind of just took a gamble and I mean, it was great. I'm glad I did.
And it certainly paid off for sure for you and generations of athletes.
That yeah, it's been a fun run.
So what inspired you to write the book? Why Sisu Lessons from the Cross Country Course?
Yeah, so I mean, one, I guess the easy answer is it was kind of just a bucket list thing to do is to write a book. I'm not super knowledgeable in a lot of different areas, so it's going to be about running or coaching for sure. You know, I'm an English teacher. I appreciate writing and so I've kind of always I had it in the back of my mind. And when I stopped coaching in 2020, you know, I guess. A hobby. I don't know if that's the right word, just something to, you know, kind of to do with my spare time. And I thought, and I, honestly, I wrote the book without the thought of anybody actually reading it. I just wanted to write a book to, so that one day, like my kids or, you know, I could look back and say, oh yeah, you know, I want to write it so I can remember good stories of when I was coaching. And it did turn out a little bit differently than I had originally planned it to be. But that's how it started, I think, was just kind of this idea of let's get it in paper and so there's memories there and so that I can check off a bucket list item.
Yeah. What was the process like for you? I'm always interested too. And when you sit down to write, was everything just flowing and you're at the keyboard typing away, or do you like a notepad and paper? What does your process look like? How did that go?
Yeah. So I started writing and I was really excited and I typed up, I don't know, maybe 5-6,000 words, like boom. And I was like, oh man, this is great. And then it wasn't so great. And it was a bit of a grind at times. And there were weeks and months where I would maybe write, I mean, literally like 30 to 50 words a day. Yeah. And then for whatever reason, I don't know why the inspiration came back after maybe about a year of just, you know, gradual, you know, movement on the writing. And that spark kind of came back and I was able to close it out pretty quickly once I got that spark back. But one thing that was interesting in the process, I had no concept of how long the book would be. And so in my mind, as an English teacher, you know, I'm picturing Grapes of Wrath, or, you know, something a couple hundred, you know, 300-500 pages long. And I realized as I was working on it that that's not really what I wanted to do. And I felt like if I was going to help, you know, a new coach or somebody who wanted to read the book, I thought maybe keeping it short and sweet and simple, I hope sweet, would be the better way to go. So that was interesting. That it turned out to be not what I pictured in my mind, but I'm still okay with how it turned out.
And for those of you listening, the book is probably about, I'd say 3/8 inch in thickness and around 80 something pages.
Yeah. It turned out to be like 88 or 90 pages.
Yeah. And we're going to get into that in the next segment in just a minute. Okay. We're back with Scott Lidskin, author of Sisu Lessons from the Cross Country Course. Scott and I have known each other for over a decade now, I think. Scott has coached my oldest daughter, Annalise, and is now coaching my youngest daughter, Emmeline, this fall in cross country. And I got to say, for me, one of my proudest moments with my kids running on the cross country course was at arguably the toughest or second toughest course in the state over at Northview.
Yeah.
My oldest daughter, Annalise, set a PR on that course in her very last
year, I remember that.
Of that year. And it was fantastic. And she just talked about how you came up to her afterwards and you were so proud of her too. And just remember, that's a hard course. And she had that look of determination. She had that look of what I'll have you describe in just a minute of Sisu as she ran that race. So we're going to talk about that. I want to preface this segment by saying this is a great read. It's a nice handbook for, like Scott said, new coaches, parents who want to learn a little bit more about what it looks like for your kid to run cross country. I'd say cross country athletes. It's a good book for you to read to understand some of the things that we're going to talk about here in just a little bit. There's humor. Scott mentioned his interview with Westfield's athletic director. I'm going to prod him a little bit to tell a little bit more details about that, as far as like how he got there and what he was wearing, what the AD was wearing. So there's some humor there. He also draws comparisons. He uses quotes from Dostoevsky, and then he compares Yoda to Curly from City Slickers.
I hope people have watched that movie.
So there's probably a certain part of the demographic that remember City Slickers. For our Gen Z and millennial listeners out there, you should definitely take a couple hours and watch that movie. It's pretty funny. But also we talk about, there's humility in there for sure, as you talk about your maybe, I don't know if hesitation to change, but your not realizing you maybe needed to change some things from 1 year to the next.
Yeah.
And then that period of self-reflection where you understood, there has to be growth and change to keep being successful. So hopefully the listener will grab some coaching hacks there. But let's get started. Let's talk about two things. I want you to kind of give us the background on Sisu.
Okay.
And then I want you to talk about the thing that you coined as being very important for, in your opinion, all coaches, but having a strong philosophy.
Yeah, for sure. And when I started coaching, I guess, I don't think I thought of it as the word philosophy. Like that word never popped in my head, but I did know, I think I mentioned in the book that like, I wanted our teams to be a certain way. You know, I had a vision of what our team would look like at practice and when we were at meets. And it really boiled down to, I really wanted our teams to be tough and teams to be prepared. I think those were kind of the two, I felt like that's the starting point. Now, the words like joy and all those words, they're equally, if not more important, but I was a 23-year-old kid and I wanted our teams to be tough and I wanted our teams to be prepared. And so that's what I really latched onto. I think I mentioned in the book that the word Sisu was not a word I was super familiar with before I got my first coaching, the first coaching job at Westfield. The word tough was, kind of the word that was in my mind, but it's I think we all, toughness is a commonly used word and it can mean a lot of different things. And it's, it can lose its meaning a little bit because we overuse it. And I knew that at the time. So I figured, all right, we're dealing with 14, 15, 16-year-old kids. Let's get a catchier term for that. And my coach used to give us season booklets at the beginning of a season or end of a season with like running quotes or famous quotes or fun quotes. I've always loved quotes because of that. And I remember just flipping through that, looking for any advice on how to coach right after I had gotten the coaching job in 96. And there was a little blurb with that word Sisu in there. And this idea of Sisu being a word from Finland, the Finnish language, that's like, I'm not Finnish at all. Okay. So I never heard of it before, but apparently if you're Finnish, you know the word Sisu. Yeah. And so I kept reading more about it and I was like, that is exactly what I'm looking for. This idea of toughness. And for those of you that don't know, there's no real one word English translation for the word Sisu, but it sort of means guts and courage and determination and grit and all that kind of stuff kind of mushed together. And I was like, that's what I want. And so, and it was catchy, it was something that you could, is interesting. You could say that and it wasn't just, oh, we got to be tough. And the kid would, kind of gloss over it. And so, I coached boys and girls my first years of coaching. We had 13 boys and we had 5 girls my first year of coaching at Westfield.
So just enough to score as a team.
And if anybody was sick, we had that happen that year, but in 96. But that crew of boys that I had, the girls were terrific as well, but those boys, they kind of really latched onto that idea of Sisu, and it made me realize, hey, you know, this could go somewhere. And then I think the next year after that, the girls kind of really started to latch onto it. And then I realized, hey, we've got something here as kind of a philosophy for our program, and it stuck.
Good. And you were transitioning from yourself, being that athlete that we talked about, the collegiate athlete, the pro athlete, to now training 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids, and taking that philosophy that you'd had, that drive as a college athlete, a pro athlete, and then transitioning to high school athletes that may be somewhere else on the spectrum of wanting to be there and that sort of thing.
For
so,
sure.
So you have to get that buy-in, and you talk a lot about leadership in your book too, and I'm sure there were some key leaders on that team from the student athletes that sort of helped bring that along. So love to hear from you. How important is the role of the student athlete leader on your teams?
Well, this may take a little bit of a left turn here, but the other interesting thing about what you just mentioned was I was actually still running professionally in 97 and 98 and all the way through 2002.
Okay.
So I was having to kind of navigate those waters, like you were talking about, of what to expect. What can you expect from a high school athlete versus what I was doing and at a professional level? And that was a challenge as well. And there are many days, my first year of coaching in 1996, I would drive up to Westfield. We would have a morning practice at six in the morning. And I'd run with them and we'd do a little workout. And then I'd drive back to Butler and do my workout that day. And then I'd go to my classes all day at Butler. And then I would drive back for the afternoon practice at Westfield. So I was getting three workouts in a day, which really actually, I'm not saying I would suggest that to everybody, but like I wound up running my best times the spring right after that fall. And I think that had a lot to do with it. So I know that's kind of a weird
term.
Yeah,
I know, but it's interesting. And there's, was there a significant increased mileage for you during that span?
I wouldn't say significant, but it was definitely an increase in mileage, but I was able to hit, you know, sort of every area of training because I was training three times a day. So, you know, I'd get some strides in and sprint work with my kids, the high school kids in the morning. Or when I came back in the afternoons, you know, I'd be running back and forth. So I might run up with the top guy for a moment, then I'd run back to run with the 12th guy and then sprint back up to the second. So I was getting all these different, you know, kind of hitting these different energy systems in training. And so I think that helped out a lot. But you asked me about leadership.
Your student athletes who become leaders on the team, how important is that to your program? And what do you guys do to encourage that? You talk about that in the book as well.
Well, yeah, I think the thing that I learned over time was I was very lucky when I started that we had terrific leaders, naturally born leaders, kids like Jimmy O'Brien, Brendan Shahovic, and Whitney Bevins, and those types of kids. And they helped propel our program. I just thought, you know, because naive, stupid, first, you know, 23-year-old coach, first-time coach, oh, that's how it always be.
Right.
And I realized that, you know, you don't always have that. You need to train kids how to be leaders just as much as you need to train them to run, you know, a 5K race.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, again, it took me probably too many years to realize that. We probably could have had better leadership earlier on. But we began some leadership training program through the winter time with our seniors or our soon-to-be seniors in our program, and just to talk to them about, you know, what does leadership mean? What does that look like? The phrase I use even today with our kids is, you know, if you're a junior and you're going to be a senior the next year, you can't look around for the seniors because you are the seniors.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's kind of been, that was always the starting point. And then, well, what does that mean? You know, and what does leadership look like? And how do we, you know, how do you figure out what your role as a leader is? And we spend, you know, a number of meetings trying to individualize that. You know, what's your skill? What is your belief system? How are you the best leader that you can be? And then how does that translate to our team? And we would have those discussions. And through time, we were able to, I think, increase the level of leadership in our program.
And you talk about those meetings that you had. It's clear in the book, too, that one of the recurring ideas is building the relationship with your team, with the individual athletes, to be able to find out what their individual skills are so that they can play a role It might not be the fastest kid on the team, but it might be the one that people go to for support when they're having a tough day or whatever their specific skill set is. It's important to have that. But without building those relationships with your athletes, you're kind of flying blind on that. So that's really important. It's a recurring theme as you talk about not only building up the athlete, but building up the team culture, and then eventually building the program.
Yeah.
All those things.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it finally hit home after a few years of coaching that, you know, coaching is education, you know, and I was a teacher. And so I think it's no different than in the classroom. If you want kids to learn better, you know, that you have to build trust and you have to build, you know, a comfort level of the student in the classroom. And it's no different with coaching. You have to build trust and you have to build a comfort level and at practice so that the athlete is willing to risk a little bit more in a race or a little bit more in training and then gradually see the improvements. And it's just time and work at that, at those relationships.
For sure. And you are going to have a wide mix of personality types and athletic ability. If you read the book and you're looking at your teams from, you know, the earliest teams that you coached and you've got in the appendix, a list of times, averages for the season. And I think your kid with the slowest time, air quotes for anybody listening. Again, I'm a running enthusiast. My old guy PR is just over 23 minutes. So when I say this, on the slow end, your athletes were running 22 minutes for the girls, which is, you know, pretty exceptional, for a lot of programs, a lot of schools here in the state. But that was sort of the slower end. These days you might have kids that are running 25, 28, 30 minutes, different makeup of the team.
Yep.
And so how does that transition the way you think about some of these things, like the individual athlete, the team culture, all those things?
Well, first of all, I've always believed that no matter, like, if you're running 15 minutes for a 5K as a high school boy or 30 minutes for a high school girl, every single kid on the team matters. And every kid is going to have moments that are going to impact the entire team. Whether that, and that might not be with a particular time or a place in a meet. It might be a moment of sisu at practice that we can say, hey, there's a model of that moment. And then everybody can take a look at it. It might be just being, like you said, a great teammate, treating others on the team well, a model in some way. So I think that's one thing that's never changed and never going to change, I think, is that if you're willing to come out and work hard and have a positive attitude and believe in sisu, not only do we want you on the team, but there's going to be a way for you to make us better. And so regardless of times, I think it's important for each kid to know that.
Right. And cross country in general has that culture of being an accepting sport and accepting team. And you get to see the growth of athletes, whether they're going from 19 and a half minutes to sub 19, or they're going from 30 minutes to 27 to 25. You see that progressing. That's gotta be a pretty good feeling as a coach. And I know you've got a lot of those stories over the years of watching athletes progress, and you tell a few stories in here.
Yeah.
You got a letter from an athlete in here who wrote a letter to the next group.
Yeah. Caitlin Luter. Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of talk to us about that a little bit. Like, as you build that team culture, what is that you hope that your athletes take away with them, and what can they do to continue to pass it on to the next generation of runners coming up?
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, again, if we take the idea of coaching cross country and we say it's similar in some way to teaching in the classroom, or it's education, I mean, we're in education-based athletics. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what I hope the kids will take from the sport is, well, one, I want it to be a joy in their lives. You know, I want it, and it doesn't mean every day is going to be, you know, the most great thing in the world, but I want it to be joyful. I want them to be able to look back and say, that was one of the most joyful things about my high school career, whether that's school or friendships or, you know, all that stuff. But I also hope that they'll take away that idea of sisu, right? So that if I can have sisu in a 5K cross country race, I can also have sisu in this difficult moment in my life when I'm 25 or 27. I don't get the job that I wanted to get, or I get let go at work, or I have a family issue that's going on. I think it's just a lifelong sort of message that can be valuable for our athletes. So, I mean, if those two things happen, if they can look back on their high school careers, So I would say, so if you, they're not going to be, my kids aren't going to probably be professional runners, most of them. So yeah. If they can look back on it and think of it as a joyful moment in their lives and take something from it and say, wow, that really helped me in a future moment, I'm over the moon happy.
That's fantastic. And kind of like going through the progression here, we've talked about leadership. We've talked about your relationships with athletes, the team culture. Mm-hmm. What it boils down to, let's go down to the individual athlete. Yeah. And this is where Yoda and Curly from City Slickers come into play.
Yeah.
So talk to me about your philosophy of one thing and the comparison of Curly and Yoda, if you will.
Yeah, and it's funny that wound up in the book that way because I love Yoda. I mean, like I don't want to make it out like I'm dissing him.
Yeah.
But the idea in the book is that the comparison was that Yoda has that famous phrase, "There is no try," basically, do or do not. And I get it. I get that message. It's like, be so resolute that you're going to complete a task and complete it well, that there's no, the try isn't even an issue. Mm-hmm. Of course that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I think the message, I think, gets lost a little bit and in that it's okay to try and it's okay to risk and it's okay to go for it a little bit, even if you might fail. So I didn't want any of my athletes or anybody to think that not trying, going forward is okay. Trying is okay. And I didn't want that message from Yoda to lose that idea. And the comparison, it wasn't a direct comparison. I mean, Curly didn't say, hey, go try.
Right.
But
right.
In City Slickers, and it is a funny movie. You're right. Anybody listening should go watch it. Although my mom, it's like one of her absolute favorite movies. She was really happy when I put that in the book. I like the movie a lot, but not like how my mom does. But anyway, in the movie, the main character, Mitch, is trying to figure out, he's having a midlife crisis a little bit. He's trying to figure out what should he do and what's important in life. And Curly says one thing, or he points to one finger basically. And Mitch is like, what one thing? And Curly's like, well, when you figure that out, you got, that's what you're living for. And I think that idea is so, oh man, it just slaps you in the face. Like, yes. And across your life. Right. And so I deal with my athletes in the running world. So for me in the running world, I want them to be able to recognize what's the one thing you're here for, right? Maybe it's social. Maybe it's to get exercise in. Maybe it's to win the state championship or become an Olympian one day, but everybody's got to find that one thing. And once you find that, you know your purpose, you know why you're here. And all of a sudden that helps us, like you just said, start to build that coach athlete relationship. Cause now I know what makes you tick a little bit better. And if we can, whenever we hit a rough patch, if we can get back to that, what's the one thing, mm-hmm. Then we can oftentimes fix that rough patch.
Yeah, it's what Simon Sinek likes to call the why.
Yeah.
Why are you here? What brings you here today?
Absolutely.
It's important to have that if you're going to do anything. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, right? you're just floating. And I don't think you get the fulfillment out of it then.
Right.
And so then it doesn't become as joyful. And so it's all kind of, it's all circular.
Like for me, I love running. So running in itself is its own intrinsic reward. And that's a good segue to when you talk about in your book, motivation. You mentioned the word joy earlier.
Yeah.
Some of the things that you've done, because practice shouldn't just be, running can be hard.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Let's throw it out there.
You're going to be tired. Yeah. You're gonna have days where it hurts
yeah.
a lot. We're not going to sugarcoat it. But there's got to be a reason that you're coming back to practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
Yeah.
And in the book, you kind of describe that. And maybe there's a coaching hack in there for some of the up and coming coaches on how you've done that to keep kids engaged, keep them motivated, help them find joy in the sport.
Yeah. I think in the book, what I really compare is the word joy and the word fun. And I have no problem with the word fun. I don't. But I do think that sometimes coaches try to generate fun. And there's no problem with that. It's a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. But I don't want coaches or anybody, especially my athletes, to lose sight of the word joy compared to fun, because I think joy is a deeper feeling. It's a deeper emotion that I can have fun by playing duck duck goose or something like that, but that's probably not lasting.
Right.
Whereas joy is, like I said a few minutes ago, where you can look back on your high school career and you're remembering only good stuff, basically. You know, you're a smile is coming to your face because of, you know, you're remembering that. And that's difficult. I mean, it's difficult to generate it, right? I mean, I think it comes back to culture on your team, and does everybody feel wanted, and does everybody feel recognized, and does everybody feel like there's an opportunity for me to express who I am and what I want to be? Especially for, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17 year old kids, this is a time in their lives where they need to feel like they have a place. And I think the better we do that, and again, that goes back to, it's circular, right? It goes back to that, creating that relationship, creating that comfort level at practice. And then hopefully because that comfort level is high, then there's more joy that's happening. Yeah, so as they look back, you know, then they'll have that joy, because it's just all a big circle, right? You start with creating the coach-athlete relationship, and then there's the comfort level that the athlete feels in the program, and then they're willing to risk, and then they start to grow and get better as individuals. And then the joy is happening because they're getting better at the sport, but they're also feeling like, this is a place for me. This is a place where I belong. And then because of that, years down the road, they're going to look back with those joyful memories of the sport.
So you talk in your book about, we talked about self-reflection a little bit. You talked about at first a hesitation to change or a lack of realization that you needed to change. Yeah. And then an understanding like, I got to change. And we talked a little bit about, you know, the uniqueness of those athletes and the uniqueness of the teams from year to year. And that's one of the things you've emphasized in your book as well. So maybe you could talk about how, first of all, you have an athlete who you're saying, it's okay to make mistakes. And you've said that in the book. It's okay to try to run.
I said it this morning in practice.
Yeah. You know, this is a learning experience. I mean, every day is a little bit different. Every race is a little bit different because of the course, because of the weather, all the intangibles.
Yeah.
So kind of talk about that, your growth progression, your openness to change, and how you see that reflect back on your student athletes.
Well, I would start by saying, as I mentioned in the book, it was a resistance to change, you know, initially. And I think part of that was just me being hard-headed and being arrogant in that, hey, well, we just won the state championship in 1998. So obviously I must know what I'm doing. And what we learned in the next 2 years is that obviously I didn't know what I was doing, or maybe not as much as I thought. And so I think it began, like I said, as a resistance to change. And then it became a hesitation, because in any field, right? I mean, if you've had success, it's just easier to keep doing what you're doing, because you feel like, all right, well, at least I'll have this amount of success. But I kind of had to let go of that to maybe get to a higher level with our teams. Mm-hmm. And so that it went from resistance to hesitation to, like you said, I think we just have to do this now, because kids were getting injured and it wasn't joyful anymore for any of us. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of started over in many ways, in terms of not with like the Sisu philosophy, but in terms of how to train athletes and how to create a better working relationship with those athletes. And so it took till that year 2000, when we call it our Voldemort year, for you Harry Potter fans out there. We don't speak of that year, but it took that year to realize, hey, we need to make some real changes. And even after we made those changes, they didn't all work, but some did. And so it made us realize, well, if we can piece together the things that work and keep trying some new things with the things that don't work, maybe we'll keep improving. And then it became like almost, I don't want to say a game, but it almost became like, I think I say it in the book, let's change just for the sake of change. Cause like it keeps things fresh. It keeps things interesting. And so we wouldn't throw out, you know, obviously really things that were working really well, but you know, there were some things where we decided not to do it when it was maybe going pretty well, just because we were like, you know, it's okay to try this, and it's okay to fail, and it's okay to learn from it. And that might all happen within one season, and we might grow from it during that season. It might help us by the end of the season.
Yeah, I really like the analogy you used, your philosophy, Sisu. That's the spine, that's the backbone, that's everything that's sort of permanent. And then the muscles, that's the change, that's the workouts.
Yes.
Those are, you're developing them with different methods, being open to the idea that you can do it multiple ways. Like we were talking about earlier before the podcast, there's so many coaches, great researchers, for the last 50, 60 years that have tried different techniques, and they're probably all right in a lot of regards.
Sure.
And some are wrong in some regards.
Absolutely.
And so that's one of the really great benefits of being able to take a step back and say, all right, we tried using the exact same schedule as we did last year, day by day, and that didn't pan out. But we know that the strength training works.
Yeah.
We know that the swimming works. We know that the different routines, there are things that you can continue to implement. And so I would love to hear, like, especially like strength training. That's one of your core tenets, I think.
Yeah, I would say so.
So talk about that and how that fits in your program.
Well, it's kind of always been there, but it's just become, I think, a little bit more organized over the years and a little bit more purposeful over the years. And that's ever changing as well, because we realize this works, this doesn't work. But yeah, it began loosely, I'd say, with just us doing, literally hundreds of push-ups. And this was before core was even like a term. I don't remember core ever. When I started coaching, I don't think nobody used the word core. We would just do, gobs and gobs of push-ups and sit-ups, and we got into the weight room, and I've always believed in some of the heavy lifts with bench press particularly, and even squatting and stuff like that. And so, but then over the years it became a little bit more organized, especially as our teams grew. We had to figure out a way to make it more organized, because like I said, when I started, we only had 18 total kids between boys and girls, and I mean, we peaked out at somewhere over 60, I think, one of my years that we had it. So we needed a way for each kid to have a chance to become stronger, and not have 5 or 6 hour practices. So we created a circuit that we do. Actually, we just did that this morning, or we taught it this morning at practice, with definitely some different drills than I've ever done in the past, or that the kids have done in the past. So again, proof that we're always changing things. But it's efficient to do a little circuit. It's about 8 minutes at 4 or 5 different stations. And we work upper body, lower body, core, stability stuff, band resistance work. And the idea of we're going to be stronger, that's going to help us become more powerful runners, which theoretically will make us faster. Mm-hmm. And that hopefully that it will decrease our chance of injury. And if we can do those two things, then that's a good starting spot for strengthening.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as I get older, and I mentioned on the podcast before, I'm getting dangerously close to that 50-year-old.
Me too.
I've found strength training again. It's been probably a couple of decades since I did it regularly, but now I go to the gym. All winter I was in the gym, doing upper body stuff while I was nursing a leg injury. And yoga has become a part of my practice now.
Absolutely.
That wasn't necessarily, I'm really taking time to stretch and think about those elements.
As you research more, you see that Olympic heavy lifting is a major element of overall body fitness. And I don't know anybody in the cross country world, be it middle school, high school, collegiate, or professional, that we're in the let's get more fit business.
Right.
And so I think that's been because of that. That's why it's been a core tenet of our program.
Very nice. I want to talk about, let's get back to, you wanted to write a book as a legacy for your children, that they would have this history of your coaching. You were also influenced by a number of different authors, both in running and now as you're reading at this stage of your life and career, different types of books. What are some of the things that are influencing you?
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about before we came on, there was an era in my coaching career where I just read everything I could get my hands on running wise. One of the books I remember that was not an X's and O's book, but it's sort of become a cult classic, is Running with the Buffaloes, And actually, I read that book right before our Voldemort season. And I certainly don't blame the author of that book for the struggles that we had that year. But I think I was so fired up after reading that book. Right. We got to run more mileage. We got to, and so that probably impacted me in both a good way and not a good way for that season. So I was reading, Jack Daniels' book and everything I could get my hands on. It was definitely a bit more running specific. And I found over the last, I'd say 3 to 5 years, I've been into books that are a little less specifically about running, a little bit more into either the mental side of improvement or growth, human growth. There's a book called The Talent Code a few years ago that I loved. We just talked before that we came on Do Hard Things. I'm reading right now in Atomic Habits. Mm-hmm. So they're not specific running related books. Although I will make a plug for Joe Newton. We talked about beforehand. Yeah. When I was in high school in Illinois, Joe Newton is like, you know, and he's no longer with us, but he is the greatest high school cross country coach, arguably in the entire country ever, from Illinois, from York High School. And he wrote, some books, Climbing to the Top of the Mountain and other, I think he wrote 4 books. And I mean, I read those somewhat regularly, or maybe not cover to cover, but you know, little parts here and there. He was sort of a master of motivation and building those relationships and building culture on his team. So I love those books too.
It's good to see it play out from the theory to the actual application on your team and witnessing it from that standpoint. Those are great books. Atomic Habits is one of my all-time favorites. I quote that frequently, or at least I think it was Robert Frost who said that. I can't remember all the books I've read, but they've all become a part of me. And apologies if it was somebody else that said that. But that's one of the books that quite frequently I'm referring back to in conversations and things like that. And it's a great tool for self-improvement, 1% better every day.
And that's sitting on my shelf. That's the next one I want to get to. But in my book, I think I mentioned it in there, but maybe it's in some speeches that I do, like that sort of the basic unit of life is the day.
Yeah.
And so often, you know, a day is similar to the previous day, and especially in teaching, right? I mean, you teach the same class over and over again, but it isn't. I mean, every day is different. And if you can make that each day, like whether it's 1% better or better in some way, I think it's a good approach to at least teaching and coaching anyway.
Yeah. So the culmination of the relationships, the team culture, building the program is going out and racing.
Yeah.
Right. So there's the intrinsic rewards of self-fulfillment. There's intrinsic rewards of going out and running a really hard workout. You mentioned SISU awards for a particular athlete who exhibited some facet of SISU on a particular day that you want people to model. And that's maybe more of an extrinsic reward where you mentioned you used to give stickers. I don't know if you still do that.
I'm a big fan of giving out gum now. Yeah, I love giving gum sticks. Yeah.
Yeah. So those kind of things that are maybe extrinsic rewards, but also intrinsically, like you want to show up that day.
Yeah. The gum's not that great. Yeah, it better be something intrinsic. It's nice to get gum, but it's not that great.
But then at the end of the season, you've positioned yourselves, run all year well, you positioned yourselves to be on the start line on that very last meet of the year. And I want you to put on your, I want you to go back and go back down memory row here.
Yeah.
And think about a couple of the championships that you won. And again, you won 4 state championships with girls over the last couple of decades. A lot more top 10 finishes and I think a runner-up finish as well.
Yeah.
But thinking about those 4, those 4 events, in your book, you mentioned you're standing 500 meters from the finish line. And the course is Laverne Gibson in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Yep.
And for anybody who's been there, you can sort of picture exactly where that spot is. It's there's a turn coming down a hill. You come through a giant archway and you see a wide open straightaway that from the side looks like it's maybe 200 meters, but don't make that mistake. Don't make that mistake. Yeah. It's probably a good 500
It's 400 from the start line to the finish line.
Yeah.
So I usually kind of position myself on that last turn.
That last turn.
Yeah.
So talk to the audience about one of those or multiple championship years. What was going through your mind as a coach as you're standing out there and you're watching your athletes, you're watching all the finishers come through, all the competitors, all your athletes. And what does that feel like? Can you give us some examples of?
Yeah. So as we mentioned earlier, like each year is different, you know, because of different circumstances. But, you know, I guess the first way to answer that question is much like I hope that our athletes are kind of locked in, to use a, a buzz phrase today. They're locked in with 4 or 5 or whatever 100 meters to go in the race. I am too. I mean, I'm fully in, my mind is not thinking about anything other than how can I help that athlete? And let's be honest, there's probably not a whole lot I can do at that point, but I'm trying anyway, whatever I can do, but I'm locked in and I'm counting places and things like that. So I don't really get to, I don't get a chance to be too reflective until I think, as you mentioned, sort of like the last, our seventh runner maybe passes through. And just the way that Laverne, the course and the whole facility is structured, it's very difficult then for me to get to the finish line before they do, because I'm waiting for our seventh runner to pass me. And by the time she's passed me, our first runner might be, you know, by the finish line.
You have that same 500 meters to go.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, as that seventh runner would pass me, then it is kind of nice the way that course is structured then, where like my job is done sort of at that point, and I can get a little reflective. And just thinking back in a couple of different years, I mean, I know the first year that we won state championship was in 1998. And that was actually at IU, not at Terre Haute for the state championship. But similarly, you kind of finished up a little uphill going into the finish at IU. And I remember being with our, I was actually right near my assistant coach, Shane Moore, at that time. And I looked over at him and we just kind of looked at each other like, maybe. Like, no, we didn't say anything, but like, we ran well. And back in those days, they didn't have chips, you know, to score the meet out. Yeah. So the athletes, they were in a finish shoot for like, I mean, 10 minutes, you know, it was a long, long, long shoot. And there was fencing that would separate where the coaches could go and where the athletes were. Mm-hmm. And again, I was maybe 24 years old. I had usually would have no problem breaking a rule and jumping over that fence to go give a high five to our athletes. But I looked over at my assistant coach, Shane Moore, one of my best friends. And I said, it's like, Shane, I think we better not hop over that fence just in case. I don't want to disqualify us or anything like that. And so we waited, you know, like 5, 10, seemed like 15 minutes before our team, you know, finally kind of moseyed their way over to us. And we were reflecting in that moment about like, gosh, I mean, we tend to kind of lock in on our teams as we watch a race. We don't really watch how this team or that team is doing. So we were trying to piece back, you know, what some of the other teams look like out of the course. And we realized, well, this is just a stupid endeavor. We have no idea how anybody else looked. And let's just be really proud of what we did, regardless of what the results were. And of course, they turned out to be good results for us that day. I remember in 2006, when we won, it was kind of much different than that. We were, I probably am exaggerating to say that we looked like a hospital ward during that week, but I know we had one of our top runners actually had to go to the hospital. She was so ill. She had to get like IV bags, you know, to rehydrate. We had another girl who was running with a stress reaction, I know, that day. And we had another girl that got sick from the girl who was sick. So 3 of our 7 were not, you know, at the top of their game. And I was at that 500 to go point and they passed me and we were doing great. I mean, they were trying hard as they could with what we had. That year I did have somebody kind of keeping an eye on some of the other teams just to be safe. And we finished it out that last 500. And I looked over at the person who was helping, you know, look at other teams. And it wasn't that side glance like I got from Shane, my assistant coach in 1998, where it was like, hey, maybe we did this. It was like, uh-oh, maybe we didn't do this. Cause we were the number one ranked team that year. We didn't lose a meet that whole season. And it was close, but luckily we held on and we did win by a few points. And so that was definitely more of like fear. And then when we found out that we had won, relief. And actually, it's funny, in this conversation that we've had here, it has gone a little bit full circle. And I remember that day thinking, man, it kind of stinks to feel relief when you have that kind of a success, you know, and winning a state championship. It should be joy. And so I feel like that word has become more and more and more important to me as a coach over the years, that even if it is close and even if we are battling through illnesses or injuries, I think there can still be joy and appreciation of what we did that day, win or lose.
Right, absolutely. It's hard to do. I mean, you went in as the presumed champions, right?
Yeah,
you
had that year we did.
You had to defend that, and it's not easy for a high schooler. I mean, we're talking about high school athletes here. And I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with Todd Corbin, who's a mindfulness coach, talking about that very same concept of getting them mentally prepared to be successful on the start line. And I mean, obviously you've been really successful at that. I mean, you've talked about a team that went to the start line and they were scared and still were able to go out and do what they needed to do that day to be a champion. Are there any other kind of memories that come out of special races that your athletes have run or championships that you want to kind of just recount here for?
I think the only thing that really jumps out right at this moment is that, like, you know, you mentioned we had teams that were, you know, were nervous and scared. Yeah. I don't like the word scared, but definitely anxious on the starting line. And that, like, that's normal, right? Like, I mean, that I think kids and even adults, we get so introspective that we don't realize, well, everybody's feeling this exact same way, no matter if you're the best or supposedly the best here, or, you know, just trying to be in the middle, or maybe you just got lucky to qualify for the state meet. Everybody's feeling that anxiety and that am I good enough type of an emotion or a feeling. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we can get our athletes or everybody on board with that idea, it almost releases the pressure a little bit, I would hope. But that definitely stands out, is that it's not like we went to the line any of those meets saying, oh, we got this, you know, we're going to win today. I mean, our kids were nervous. Our coaches were anxious. But that's where having that philosophy of SISU and something that, like you said, like as we said in the book, that spine, that backbone to kind of like keep you standing up straight and tall that day, that definitely really helps get through those difficult moments.
And what other elements of your book do you think are beneficial to that up and coming coach, that maybe 23, 24 year old coach that was in the same shoes you were in? Maybe they're an assistant coach and they're looking to make an impact on a team, or maybe they've taken over a program. Like, are there any other coaches' hacks that you would throw out to them as far as things that you wished you would have known when you were that 23-year-old?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a little section there about a girl named Mary that we coached, who was really not one of our fast runners on the team, but she kind of became a rallying point for a team that we had in 2004 that wound up as the state runner-up. And I think as coaches, we get really locked in on our varsity team and our varsity team's success and results, because that's what's in the newspaper, that's what's going to be on a website, or, you know, what have you. But the truth is, you know, if you're at a big school like we are, and I have 50 girls on my team this year, only 7 of them are going to get to run in the postseason. Mm-hmm. And so 43 of those other girls are, you know, equally important to those 7. And we want that experience to be as joyful and memorable in a positive way as for those 7 who are running in the postseason. And so I think that story about Mary and how, you know, I think she was just trying to break 20 minutes for 4K back in the day when we ran 4K here in Indiana, which was certainly, it's a modest time. It's nothing bad, but, you know, certainly not going to be anywhere on any varsity team of a team that's, you know, a regional or semi-state or state meet caliber team. But to understand the importance of every person and how every person matters in the program, things we've talked about already during this podcast, I think that story of Mary really, I think, hits home, because I'm not a math guy, but think about the percentage of the kids that you're going to coach over your lifespan that are going to be JV runners that will never run a varsity race compared to the kids that do. And I think setting up a training plan and a culture for those kids is probably more important than the kids who are going to be on the line at the state meets.
Right, making sure that they feel valued. Maybe are trained to peak at the point of the season where their season's going to end, and not necessarily for, you know, that championship meet.
Yeah, and you're saying exactly right, that they're trained mentally, physically, and emotionally to for excellence.
Yeah.
Because we say this all the time. Every kid in our program can shoot for excellence. There's no bench. You know, I don't decide who runs and who doesn't run at our invites. Everybody's out there going. And so, you know, if every kid is shooting for excellence, then you get this whole synergy stuff going, and everybody becomes maybe a little bit better than that Dostoevsky quote, you know, that everybody becomes a little bit better than what we thought we would be.
Great. We're going to come back for the third segment in just a second here, and we'll catch up with what you have going on next. All right, we're back with Scott Litzkin, author of Sisu, Lessons from the Cross Country Course. Scott, so you are back at the helm of the Westfield High School girls cross country team after a couple of years hiatus. So in addition to that, what else do you have going on? What's next for you?
Well, right now, that's what's next for sure. This summer of 2023, we're getting ready for the season. And then in the fall, this will be our main focal point. But I'm a very family-oriented person. I mean, my family is, this is what was a difficult decision to return to coaching was because, to be quite honest, the last 3 years have been amazingly cool for me and spending so much extra time with them. I have two daughters, a seventh grader now, gosh, you'd kill me. And then a third grader. And so I'm spending every minute that I can with them. Cause man, time goes fast, as you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my gosh. Yeah. You probably feel like your kids were just in that age group.
It seems like it. And then Annalise just graduated last week and she's
how does that happen?
In the fall.
How does that
ready
happen?
To go,
right.
Time goes. So yeah, definitely worth making sure you stay focused on the family and then that prom.
Yes. And then, you know, it's been interesting that there will be sort of an interconnection, I think, I hope, between the running world and my family. My wife is amazing and she's been kind of a coach's wife for many, many years. And the sacrifices with that are, I mean, I'm so grateful of how, just how flexible she has been. And then my oldest daughter looks like she's really got that running bug. She's kind of inherited the family business a little bit. And my youngest, I think my favorite moments still, and I did dabble in a little bit of volunteer coaching of the middle school program at Westfield last year. But some of my favorite moments still are my youngest just seeing me at the meet and like sprinting up to me and giving me a giant hug, even if it's like in the middle of the race. Man, she doesn't care, you know?
Right. That's
so, yeah, exactly. And so yeah, they mean a ton to me. So every minute that I can, I'm spending with them and coaching and teaching and just trying to soak in what how fast that time goes, what little time we have.
Yeah, definitely enjoy it. And also you're involved with Indiana Runner website. You appear on podcasts throughout the cross country season.
Yeah.
So give the listeners a little bit of information about that, a plug for Indiana Runner.
Yeah, IndianaRunner.com is a website. I think we're kind of even more than a website. I mean, we put on indoor track events. Mm-hmm. Like you said, we have podcasts and it's really kind of found a cool little niche of popularity in our state amongst high school and athletes and parents and coaches. And yeah, if you go and visit that site, we have a message board that's pretty popular, I would say. And we'll keep track of results really well. We do podcasts, we do rankings and it's just kind of a neat place to go. It's like a hub, I guess you'd say, of both statistics and opinions. And so I think, you know, anytime you get to talk about high school running, you know, and look at information about it, it's kind of a fun place to go to. So yeah, if you get a chance to visit IndianaRunner.com, it's a nice place to go.
I'm a subscriber to the podcast, and I know there's a lot of parents, a lot of athletes that look for that bell to ring, that podcast to drop after the races on Saturday to find out who did what.
Yeah, Colin Altavoet, you know, he loves to use that term shout out. So shout out to Colin for starting those podcasts because they've become, you know, really a kind of a center point of our website and he does a great job.
And I don't want to discount the track meets. I had a chance to attend a few of those this winter with my youngest daughter, Emmeline. She ran her first indoor meets, and they're a lot of fun. You draw big crowds to those.
Yeah.
I think how many do you do? Three? Four?
We do a series of three meets, and we're really proud of those. We feel like we put on a good product, and if you're into distance running at all, there's a lot of different kids that come and run in those meets. You get, you know, state champions who are, you know, really running fast, and you get some kids that are, you know, they just want a chance to get on an indoor track because don't want to run out in the snow every day. And, you know, we'll take anybody.
The book again is Sisu, Lessons from the Cross Country Course. You can get an autographed copy from the runnerdlibrary.com/shop.